Both were drinking martinis and watching the room like a pair of hawks, sizing up the local pigeon population. What about them? Irene asked.
They both checked in today. They spent the last 6 weeks in Reno at a divorce ranch, and now they're free.
Irene picked up her pink lady. We in the gossip paper business call it taking the Reno cure. The notorious quickie divorces available in Nevada were simple enough from a legal point of view, and they had certainly made things much easier for women, especially to escape an unhappy marriage. In other states, the process often took a year or longer, and the laws strongly favored the husbands. But obtaining a Nevada divorce was not cheap, Irene reflected. For starters, you had to be able to afford to move to Nevada and establish residency for 6 weeks. The Reno cure carried with it a strong whiff of scandal, of course, as did any other kind of divorce, but there was no denying that the state of Nevada was doing a booming business. People who were killing time waiting for the legal process to play out spent a lot of money at hotels, restaurants, and casinos. What about the two women fresh in from Reno? She asked.
They're looking for rich husbands to replace the ones they've just got rid of.
My manager informed me that the blonde asked to have her room switched to the one that is closer to that bald man sitting at the table with a bored-looking young woman in blue. Both he and his companion have had enough of each other. She's got her eye on another man, and he's looking for someone even younger. Irene blinked, a little shocked in spite of herself. And here I thought that those of us in the gossip business had a somewhat cynical view of human nature, she said.
I'm not the one who concluded that a fast-rising movie star might be a murderer. Talk about cynical.
Point taken. So, Mr. Magic, do you see a killer down there in the dining room? He contemplated the scene for a long moment.
If I'm right, we're watching for a man who checked in recently and who is traveling alone. I got the list of new guests here at the Burning Cove from the front desk. There are only a handful of names on it.
But he might not be staying here.
That is one of the unknowns, Oliver admitted.
You're probably right that regardless of where he's staying, he will be alone. I suppose the last thing a killer would want is a traveling companion.
I still believe that the odds are very good that the killer is also from the East Coast, Oliver continued. He'll have an accent and a certain style of dress, and he's rich.
You say that because he left that necklace behind in Helen's safe? Oliver's smile was ice cold.
A common thief would have been unable to resist such a tempting valuable.
I think I'm beginning to see how you go about building up a profile of an individual you've never even met.
Like I said, it's not that hard once you learn to pay attention to the details. Bartenders do it on a regular basis. Take Willie, for instance.
Who is Willie?
The head bartender here at the hotel. She used to be one of my assistants.
I thought most bartenders were male.
Oliver smiled. Most are. Willie is a little different. You'll see when you meet her.
She can do what you do when it comes to reading people.
She's very good at it. So is my concierge, Mr. Fontaine. Enough about our problem. It's been a long day and I'm hungry.
So am I, Irene said, surprised by the discovery.
I can recommend the abalone.
I've never had abalone, she said.
Welcome to California.
Chapter 41.
2 hours later, they walked back through the front door of Casa del Mar. Oliver had a list of guests. Most male, but some female, who had caught his interest for one reason or another.
When he needed a name to go with someone on the list, the waiter checked with the maitre d' to provide it. Irene had been so caught up in the list-making process, demanding to know why Oliver selected certain guests out of a room full of people, that she had not had an opportunity to worry about what would happen after dinner. It was, she thought, just barely possible that the pink lady and the white wine that was served with the abalone might have had something to do with her failure to think ahead. The problem was that she and Oliver had not discussed the sleeping arrangements. It wasn't the sort of thing a lady brought up in conversation, not in a classy dining room. A great awkwardness descended on her. The tour of the prop locker had turned her world upside down. Unable to think of anything else to do, she paused at the foot of the stairs, one hand on the railing, and gave Oliver what she hoped was a cool, gracious smile. "Thanks for a lovely evening," she said, "even if we did spend most of it talking about a killer."
"Never say I don't know how to show a lady a good time."
His wry tone disturbed her. She took her hand off the railing and touched the side of his face. "I'm not sure what I should say at this moment," she whispered. He caught her hand in his and kissed her palm. When he looked at her, she saw a shattering honesty in his normally unreadable eyes.
"I'm not sure what I should say either," he said, "but I know what I want to say."
She was suddenly breathless. "What is that?"
"Please don't go upstairs tonight. Please say you'll come down the hall to my bedroom instead."
"Yes," she said. She brushed her lips across his. "Yes." Chapter 42. The following morning, Luther arrived just as Irene and Oliver were finishing breakfast on the patio. Oliver waved him to a chair. Irene poured a cup of coffee for him.
"I've got news," Luther said.
"Good or bad?" Irene asked.
"Just news," Luther said. "I contacted some people I know back east. There has been no progress in the Helen Spencer murder case. Officially, it remains an active investigation, but my informant told me that unofficially, the police have given up. They've concluded that it was either a random crime committed by a deranged individual, probably a transient, or the missing private secretary."
Irene caught her breath. "So there's been no progress, and I'm still a suspect."
"If it's any comfort, I think the police are leaning toward the deranged transient theory," Luther said.
"Why?" Irene asked.
Oliver looked at her.
"Probably because of the necklace."
"Yes," Luther said. "The thinking is that the secretary was not insane. According to the housekeeper and the butler, she was a skilled professional. If she had murdered her employer, the crime would most likely have been done with the goal of stealing something quite valuable."
"Such as the necklace," Oliver concluded. "Any progress on that front?"
"As reported in the newspapers, it was an extremely valuable item that went missing from a hotel safe in London shortly before Helen Spencer was murdered."
Irene gripped the arms of the rattan chair. "Miss Spencer traveled to London 3 weeks before she was killed." Luther's brows rose.
"Evidently, your employer traveled abroad frequently, and she kept an apartment in Manhattan."
"That's right," Irene said. A queasy sensation roiled her stomach. "I'm the one who booked her tickets and made her travel arrangements. I sometimes accompanied her."
"Spencer always stayed in the best hotels, didn't she?" Luther continued. "She attended parties in the homes of wealthy people."
Irene went cold. "What exactly are you implying?" Oliver gave Luther a knowing look.
"You think Helen Spencer was a jewel thief, don't you?"
Luther shrugged.
"It would explain a lot."
Irene stared at him, stunned. "I can't believe it."
"Makes sense," Oliver said. "She probably stumbled onto Atherton's notebook when she cracked a safe in search of jewelry. She would have suspected immediately that the notebook was valuable. Why else stash it in a hotel safe?"
"I think that is the most reasonable way to explain how Spencer acquired the notebook," Luther said. "It's possible that she was a professional spy who was paid to steal the notebook. But I think it's far more likely that she was a thief who got very unlucky when she stole Atherton's notes.
Dear heaven! Irene shook her head, dazed. I lived in her house for nearly a year. How could I have not guessed the truth? I was so naive. I thought she was my friend.
It sounds like she was your friend, Oliver said quietly. Toward the end, she must have begun to realize that the notebook was not only valuable, it was dangerous. She tried her best to protect you in case something happened to her.
Irene thought about the message written in blood on the silver-flocked wallpaper.
Run.
Yes, she whispered.
Luther looked at her. Did Spencer meet with anyone in the days before she was murdered?
I don't know, Irene said. She had just returned from Europe. She went there alone. I spent the time in the New York apartment. She sent a telegram from London giving me the date her ship was due to arrive. I was to meet her at the pier. We were going to drive up to the country house together. But the information in the telegram was wrong. Miss Spencer was not on the ship. I discovered that she had arrived 2 days earlier. She must have gone straight to the country house.
Yet she knew that you were waiting for her in New York, Oliver said.
Yes, Irene said. I wasn't the only one who got the wrong information. The housekeeper and butler were expecting Miss Spencer to return 2 days later as well. Looking back, I think it's obvious that she deliberately deceived us. She wanted some time alone at the country house.
Time to make a deal for the notebook, perhaps, Oliver said.
Irene looked at him. And time to meet her lover. He murdered her for the notebook.
That's what it looks like, Luther said. What made you decide to drive to Spencer's country house that evening?
When I found out that she had arrived on a ship that docked 2 days earlier, I was frantic, Irene said. I couldn't find her in New York. None of her friends had seen her. I telephoned the country house, but there was no answer. I was afraid that she was there alone, had perhaps taken ill or fallen down the stairs. By then it was very late in the day. It's a long drive, and I was delayed by a bridge that had been closed due to the heavy rains. I didn't arrive until nearly midnight.
So you got into your car and drove all the way to the mansion, even though you knew you would be driving a mountain road at night, Luther concluded.
Irene looked at him. Miss Spencer was very good to me. I would have done just about anything for her. If only I had arrived a few hours earlier.
If you had, you too would probably be dead, Luther said.
Irene took a deep breath. Yes, that thought has occurred to me every minute of every waking hour since I found Helen's body.
Oliver reached across the table and squeezed her hand.
You were alone that night. You're not alone now.
The phone rang a short time later, just as Luther was preparing to leave the villa.
Hold on, Oliver said. That may be Brandon with some news about Springer.
He grabbed his cane and disappeared into the villa. Irene was left alone on the patio with Luther.
I know you're involved in this mess because you're Oliver's friend, she said earnestly, not because of me. But I want you to know how much I appreciate your help. I would apologize for bringing so much trouble to Burning Cove, but that won't do any good. I can only tell you that I had no idea things would turn out to be so dangerous.
Luther drank the last of his coffee and set the cup in the saucer.
It's true you have livened things up here in our little town, but there's no need for apologies. If anything, I owe you my thanks.
Bewildered, she could only stare at him. What on earth for? He gave her an unreadable smile.
Oliver and I have a tendency to sink into boredom occasionally.
I find that difficult to believe. Each of you is responsible for a large business enterprise. I'm sure your various financial interests keep you occupied.
It's true, our businesses do occupy much of our time, but a man can only review so many budgets before it all becomes predictable and routine.
Murder is hardly an ideal cure for boredom.
Luther chuckled.
When you live in a small town like Burning Cove, you can't be too choosy when it comes to diversions.
You're teasing me,
You've got me there. But it looks to me like you're doing my friend Oliver a world of good. So I'm willing to cut you some slack when it comes to murder.
How can you say that? I nearly got him killed at that warehouse the other night.
Yes, well, don't get me wrong. I'm glad you didn't actually succeed. I am acquainted with a lot of people, but Oliver is one of the few that I can call a friend. One of the very few I trust.
Look, Mr. Pell.
Luther.
Luther, this is not a laughing matter.
Probably not, he agreed. But you see, the news of exactly what happened at that warehouse is all over town.
Then you know Oliver could have died in the fire or been shot by one of those two men on motorcycles.
What I know, Luther said, is that you were on your way out of that burning warehouse when Oliver lost his balance and fell. You turned back to help him.
Well, of course I did. It was my fault he was in harm's way in the first place. Besides, one doesn't leave one's partner behind.
No, Luther said. One doesn't. But not everyone understands that. You went back to help my friend. That's all that matters to me.
She studied him for a long moment. You really have been concerned about him, haven't you?
Sometimes, Luther said. He takes that souped-up cord of his out onto an empty stretch of highway, and he drives it very, very fast. I think he uses it as an antidote for the pain.
The pain of his old injury?
That is the least of it, Luther said. He lost something far more valuable than a lucrative career when he nearly died on stage. But that is for him to tell you.
I think you understand him very well, Irene said. I assume that it's because you have also experienced real pain. You said that Oliver's antidote is to drive his car too fast. Tell me, what remedy do you use? The edge of Luther's mouth twitched a little in amusement.
You are very perceptive. I shall have to remember that in future.
You paint, Irene said, very sure of her conclusion. That is how you deal with the pain, isn't it? Luther narrowed his eyes. He no longer looked amused.
As I said, you are very perceptive.
Oliver emerged from the living room before Irene could say anything else.
That was Brandon, all right, Oliver said.
Springer was discharged from the hospital this morning. He was booked into the Burning Cove jail approximately 20 minutes later. Not long afterward, a hotshot lawyer from L.A. arrived and bailed Springer out of jail.
Who sent the lawyer? Luther asked. I doubt if a guy like Springer has that kind of money.
Brandon assumes that Hollywood Mac or the studio fixer Ernie Ogden is responsible for the lawyer, Oliver said.
So a known arsonist is running around free in Burning Cove? Irene asked. That's outrageous.
Oliver looked at her. Brandon said the only good news is that Springer was last seen buying a train ticket to L.A.
Chapter 43. Graham Enright clamped his hand around the telephone.
What the hell do you mean you were playing tennis when I called earlier? I didn't send you out to California to take a vacation. You're supposed to be working.
Calm down, Julian said, his voice rendered distant and a bit scratchy by the long-distance connection. I am working. I've got a plan, and Nick Tremaine is a critical element. Everything is under control.
How much longer do you intend to spend finishing this assignment?
Things have gotten a little complicated.
Graham drummed his fingers on his desk.
How complicated?
I searched the apartment in L.A. very thoroughly. There was no sign of the notebook. Interestingly, someone got to her place before me. The studio people, I think. But I doubt that they found the notebook. Even if they had, the goons wouldn't have recognized its real value. I'm sure she brought it here to Burning Cove. I'm told she was staying at a local inn. But now she's a guest at Ward's private villa.
Who is Ward?
ex-magician. Not a very good one, apparently. Almost got himself killed in his last performance.
Are you talking about Oliver Ward?
Right. Ever see his act?
No, but I remember the headlines when he nearly got killed on stage. What does he have to do with this situation?
He owns the Burning Cove Hotel. Anna Harris, she's calling herself Irene Glasson now, moved in with him very soon after she arrived in Burning Cove. My guess is that she's hoping he'll be able to help her find a buyer for the notebook. Ward is friends with the owner of a local nightclub, Luther Pell. Pell's got mob connections.
You think Ward and Harris, or Glasson, or whatever she's calling herself, are working together now?
Glasson may believe that they're partners, but it's far more likely that he's running a con on her. That's the only thing that makes sense. There's no other reason why he'd be sleeping with a gossip columnist from a cheap Hollywood newspaper. Gotta hang up now. I have to talk to the hotel concierge about booking a restaurant this evening.
Damn it! What about the project? I thought I made it clear the reputation of Enright and Enright is on the line. Our business is founded on the twin pillars of absolute discretion and successful results. We are poised to take a huge step into the global marketplace. A failure of this magnitude will do serious damage to the firm.
I'll have this business wrapped up in just a few more days. Gotta go. I'll call as soon as I have the notebook. The line went dead. Irritated, Graham dropped the receiver into the cradle and got to his feet. He went to stand at the window of his office and contemplated the busy Manhattan streets far below. His son was talented and ambitious. In addition, Julian possessed the feral instincts and the intelligence required to take the helm of Enright and Enright. But there was no getting around the fact that the boy had been indulged from the cradle. The result was a spoiled, impulsive young man. It did not matter that he was spoiled. The Enrights had always moved in wealthy, socially elite circles. Julian was a product of his upbringing. It was only natural that he was accustomed to privilege and the finer things in life. It was the impulsiveness that was worrisome. The trait had been evident since Julian was a toddler, but it was becoming increasingly pronounced. Perhaps it was a direct result of his string of successes, Graham thought. When a man got accustomed to committing murder and getting away with it time and again, it was only to be expected that he might start to think himself invincible. Julian needed to learn control. He needed to mature. But there would be ample opportunity in the future to guide him and shape him, so that he could fulfill his destiny. First things first. It was imperative that the notebook be recovered, and the woman who was calling herself Irene Glasson be terminated. A buzzing sound interrupted his thoughts. He went back to his desk and pressed a button.
Yes, Miss Kirk.
Mr. Duffield is here to see you, sir. He wishes to discuss his will.
Thank you, Miss Kirk. Please send him in.
Yes, sir.
The door opened, and Raina Kirk ushered Duffield into the room. He was a frail man in his early 80s who was quickly going senile. Just the sort of client that Graham cultivated to maintain a facade of legitimacy and respectability for the firm. It was Duffield and his ilk who unwittingly provided access to certain social circles, and, most important of all, the inside information that so often proved useful to the real work of Enright and Enright. Raina took Duffield's arm and escorted him to one of the client's chairs.
Thank you, young lady, Duffield cackled.
Raina smiled, politely ignoring the lecherous grin on the old man's face.
You're quite welcome, Mr. Duffield.
She stepped back and looked at Graham.
Will there be anything else, sir?
That's all for now, Miss Kirk, Graham said.
Yes, sir.
Raina left, the door closed behind her. Graham suppressed a small sigh. Raina Kirk was another problem that would have to be dealt with fairly soon. She had sent one too many coded telegrams, overheard one too many snippets of conversation, booked one too many hotel rooms for Julian, recorded one too many unusual financial transactions. Lately, Graham had begun to suspect that she had listened in on some of his telephone calls.
No question but that the time had come to fire Raina Kirk. She would not be the first private secretary he had been forced to let go, Graham thought. That meant he would soon be seeking a new woman for the position. Replacing a competent secretary with an equally skilled one who had no close family was always a challenge. He had followed the policy his father set down when the business was founded. He made certain that his private secretaries were single women of a certain age who possessed no close relatives. Relatives could be a problem when it came time to terminate a secretary, and sooner or later each had to be fired. The position required a woman well-versed in the secretarial arts. Her typing, dictation, bookkeeping, and organizational skills had to be excellent. But such women were also quite intelligent and insightful. Eventually, they learned too much about the firm's lucrative sideline. When Julian returned from California, he would deal with Miss Kirk, just as he had dealt with her predecessor. Replacing Kirk wouldn't be easy, Graham thought. She was the most talented secretary he had ever hired. But an executive had to do what was best for the firm. There was one benefit to firing secretaries. The exercise was an excellent way for Julian to keep his knife skills sharp. Chapter 44.
"Mr. O'Connor is here to see you, sir,"
Elena said over the intercom. Oliver pressed a button. "Good. Send him in, please, Elena." The door opened and Tom O'Connor walked into the office. He was in his 40s, a big, muscular, ruddy-faced man who handled security for the amazing Oliver Ward show. He wore the dark jacket, trousers and tie that were the day uniform for the men on his staff. Tom's clothes, like all the other staff uniforms, were supplied by the hotel. They were cleaned and pressed regularly by the housekeeping department, so Tom always started the day looking crisp and tailored. But somehow, within an hour after arriving for work, he managed to look rumpled. Oliver lounged back and wrapped his fingers around the arms of his chair.
"Have a seat, Tom. What have you got on the crazy fan?"
"Not much. His name is Henry Oakes, and he's nuts about Nick Tremaine."
Tom settled his bulk into a chair.
"Oakes checked into the Seaside Motel a day after Tremaine showed up here. Has coffee and two fried eggs at Mel's Cafe every morning. Comes back for coffee and a meatloaf sandwich at dinner."
"Meatloaf?"
"It's always meatloaf for dinner, according to the waitress. Always two fried eggs in the morning. Oakes appears to be a creature of habit. The waitress said he was very precise about how he wanted his eggs and the sandwich. She also says he's creepy."
"Irene mentioned that. What does he do at night?"
"Well, that's where things get a little interesting. Parker, the guy who handles security at the Carousel Club, told me that he spotted Oakes outside the club the same night that Tremaine spent a couple of hours there."
"That was the night that Gloria Maitland drowned in the spa."
"Yeah. Parker said he noticed Oakes standing in the shadows, watching the front door of the club. Parker thought he might be a chauffeur or a bodyguard, but when Parker asked him who he was waiting for, Oakes just walked away. Hasn't shown up again, at least as far as Parker knows."
"Anything else?"
"Nothing solid. We've seen the type before, boss. Every month or so we catch some screwy fan trying to sneak onto the property."
"Tell everyone on the staff, I mean everyone, housekeepers, kitchen crew, gardeners, as well as your people, to watch for Henry Oakes. If he shows up, I want to know immediately."
"Want me to have a little talk with Oakes?"
Tom raised his brows.
"I could strongly advise him to leave town. I can make sure he's on the late afternoon train to L.A.
"If we send him back to L.A., we'll lose track of him. I think we're better off knowing where he is. Like I said, if he shows up on the property, I want to know about it.
I'll get the word out."
Chapter 45. Willie liked polishing martini glasses and suspending them by their stems in the overhead rack.
She found the chore soothing, a form of meditation. She was engaged in the practice when Irene walked into the lounge looking like a woman who needed a confidant. Willie recognized the expression. When you work behind a bar, you saw it a lot. It was going on 10 o'clock in the morning, and there were no guests in the bar yet. That was not unusual. Some of the early risers were playing either golf or tennis. Several were working off the effects of the previous night's partying, with a massage and a stint in the spa steam room. A few were sleeping late, not necessarily with their own spouses. She had already sent several orders of her signature eye-opener, Red Sally, a cocktail involving tomato juice, vodka, and a lot of salt and hot sauce, to people who had ordered room service. Irene hitched up her trousers, plunked herself down on a bar stool, and folded her arms on the polished wooden surface. So this is the boss's new lady friend, Willie thought. She was as curious about Irene as everyone else on the staff.
You must be Miss Glasson, she said. Welcome to the Burning Cove Hotel. I'm Willie, by the way.
Irene had walked in with the look of a woman who was lost in her own thoughts, but at the greeting she immediately refocused her attention and smiled. The smile was real, Willie decided. She saw all kinds. She was pretty good at separating the false ones from the genuine article. All that experience as a magician's assistant had served her well in her new career.
You worked with Oliver in his show, didn't you? Irene said.
Oliver told you about me.
A little, not much. He mentioned that several of the people employed here at the Burning Cove, including you, had worked with him in the amazing Oliver Ward show.
That's right, Willie said. After the show closed, Mr. Ward could have let us all go. Instead, he used every last dime he had to buy this hotel. He couldn't afford to pay us back at the start, but we had room and board, so we stuck around. The place started turning a profit last year. The pay is good, so we're all still here. What can I get you?
Do you serve coffee in here?
I do.
In that case, I'll have some, thank you.
Willie set a cup and saucer on the bar, picked up a pot, and poured the coffee.
I see the boss let you out on your own this morning, she said. Does that mean he thinks your problem has been resolved?
Irene drummed her fingers on the counter. I suppose everyone on the staff knows that Oliver thinks I need round-the-clock security.
Sure. We also know that you helped him get out of that burning warehouse the other night.
Irene sipped some coffee. As I keep pointing out to people, it was my fault that he was in that warehouse in the first place. Willie picked up another glass and started polishing it.
The boss makes his own rules. If he was there with you, it was because he wanted to be there.
That's more or less what he told me.
It's the truth. We all know he's worried about your safety. He's always had good security here at the hotel, but during the past few days, he's given orders to double down on the routine patrols, and he's cranked up the lighting at night. The grounds are lit up like a stage at 3 in the morning now. That said, you seem to be running free today.
Irene wrinkled her nose.
For a while. He's handling some business in his office. I didn't want to sit there staring at him or reading a magazine while he made telephone calls and did whatever hotel executives do. He figured I'd be safe here in the bar.
He's right. We've got good security in here, too. There's a button I can push if I don't like what's going on. One of the guards would be here in a minute or two at the most.
That's good to know. Irene patted her handbag. I'm not helpless. I've got a gun.
So do I, Willie said. She held the martini glass up to the light to check her work. I keep it under the bar.
Interest and curiosity sparked in Irene's eyes.
Really?
Old habit from the days when we were on the road. Some towns were rougher than others. Every so often, some jerk decided to rob the ticket office or hassle one of the assistants.
You, for instance.
Willie gave her a humorless smile.
Me, for instance.
Does Oliver know about the gun under the bar?
Yes.
He told me he doesn't like guns.
What do you expect? He almost got killed by one.
He says guns give people a false sense of security. He says you never know when one will jam on you.
Sounds like the two of you had an extensive conversation on the subject.
Uh-huh.
Irene drank some more coffee and put the cup down with great care. Once in another life, I had an employer who owned a gun, but in the end it didn't do her any good. She was murdered by some bastard who used a knife.
What happened?
She made the mistake of trusting the wrong person.
Trust is a dangerous thing.
Yes, it is, Irene said, but you get very lonely if you don't have someone you can trust.
You can trust the boss.
Irene smiled. He obviously trusts you.
We go back a ways.
Irene turned thoughtful. He says you can read people as well as he can.
Bartenders in general are good at reading people. You could say it's a job requirement.
Irene met her eyes. You probably know that I'm suspicious of Nick Tremaine.
Everyone who reads the newspapers knows that.
Care to give me your take on him?
Willie chuckled. Funny you should ask.
Why?
Because the boss asked the same question the morning your story broke in whispers. I'll tell you the same thing I told him. I think Nick Tremaine is very, very ambitious. I also think he's got a temper.
Ever seen him lose it?
No, but the other day I happened to see that personal assistant of his after she came out of his villa. She looked shaken, downright scared, I think.
Claudia Picton? I think she's terrified of losing her job. Irene took a sip and set her cup down on the saucer with a clink. My intuition tells me she's the weak link in this thing. I need to speak with her again. That means I have to get her alone.
The boss might not approve.
I've seen enough of Claudia Picton to know that she'll never open up if Oliver is with me. He'll intimidate her.
You're probably right. It's obvious that Miss Picton's nerves are in bad shape. Wouldn't take much to send her into a complete panic.
What else do you know about her? Irene asked.
Not a lot. She doesn't come into my bar.
Maybe she doesn't drink.
Either that or the studio won't cover her bar tab, Willie said.
I didn't see her in the restaurant last night, but I guess that's no surprise. Most women don't like to be seen dining alone.
Maybe she went out to a local cafe, Willie suggested.
Who would know?
Willie smiled. The concierge, Mr. Fontaine. When it comes to the habits and preferences of the guests, a good concierge is better than a private detective.
Think Mr. Fontaine will talk to me?
Only if Mr. Ward tells him to talk to you.
I need to call Oliver.
There's a house telephone behind the bar.
May I use it?
Help yourself.
Irene moved around behind the bar and reached for the receiver. Thanks, Willie, she said. You've been very helpful. Willie held up another glass to the light to check her polishing job.
Happy to be of service. Out of curiosity, how do you plan to persuade Miss Picton to meet with you in private?
I don't. I'm going to stage an ambush. Irene concentrated on the telephone. Please connect me with Mr. Ward's private office. Thank you. Yes, I'll wait.
Willie smiled to herself.
Something amusing? Irene asked.
I was just thinking that you're a good influence on the boss.
A good influence? Are you joking? I found a dead body in his spa, and I nearly got him killed.
You wouldn't believe how he's perked up since you arrived at the hotel. You've done wonders. A regular tonic.
Chapter 46. Elena appeared in the office doorway.
I just received Detective Brandon's list of guests who recently checked in at the other hotels, inns, and B&Bs in town, she said. Oliver looked up from the list of new arrivals at the Burning Cove Hotel.
Several of the so-called singles from back east on my list are actually traveling with a personal maid or a private secretary. I've excluded them. That leaves me with 8 names. How many on Brandon's list?
Another 20 in all, but most are from California, L.A. or San Francisco for the most part. Our hotel gets the majority of the East Coast crowd here because, like the Beverly Hills Hotel and the Biltmore in L.A., we are quite well known.
The benefits of advertising. Thanks, Elena. This was, he concluded, probably one of the few times in history of the industry that the proprietor of a hotel hoped his establishment's reputation for elegance and service had served as a lure to attract a killer. Never a dull moment these days, not with Irene around. Elena put the list on his desk and went back to the doorway, where she paused and gently cleared her throat. Oliver looked up again, suddenly wary.
What is it? He said.
I just wanted to say that you are looking very well today.
Have I been looking unwell previously?
No, sir, it's just that you seem to be in excellent spirits today, especially considering the circumstances.
Nothing like hunting for a killer to put a man in an upbeat mood, Oliver reflected.
Probably the 3 cups of coffee I drank at breakfast, he said.
Elena chuckled.
No doubt.
Remember, not a word about these lists and the people on them.
Understood. She was about to close the door, but stopped when the outer door burst open. Chester charged into the front office.
Where's Oliver? He demanded.
Right here,
Oliver called through the opening.
Come on in, Chester.
Chester rushed into the room, bristling with excitement. He had Atherton's notebook in one hand.
Wait until I tell you what's in this thing, he said.
Sit down, Oliver said.
He looked at Elena.
That's all for now, thanks.
She left, closing the door quietly behind her. Chester put the notebook down on the desk and dropped into one of the chairs.
What do you know about radio waves?
I know how to turn on a radio, and I know how to turn it off. Why?
Radio waves are a form of electromagnetic radiation, and they have several very interesting properties. Most metal objects, for example, reflect radio waves.
So,
the British and the U.S. military have been conducting secret research designed to see if radio waves can be used to detect airplanes at a considerable distance and ships at sea.
Understanding began to dawn.
I'm listening, Oliver said.
The work is still in the experimental stage. I'm told the Brits are ahead of us because they're so damn worried about Germany. But other nations, including Russia, Germany, and Japan, are also doing research in this area. There are serious limitations with the current equipment. The antennas are huge and the wavelengths are too long, but theoretically, utilizing a pulsing technique and shorter wavelengths, it should be possible to build a compact device that would allow radio waves to detect ships at sea.
To help avoid collisions?
Sure, but what interests the U.S. Navy is the possibility of using radio waves to find enemy vessels at a distance. Currently, the process for aiming a battleship's big guns involves the risk of getting close enough to the target to see where the shells land. After you get a visual on the first shot, you calibrate the next shot and so on. In addition, all sorts of other information must be cranked into the calculations. The pitch and roll of the ship, for example. It's complicated work that must be done at a close range, which entails a lot of risk.
Oliver picked up the notebook.
Are you telling me that Atherton's calculations have something to do with engineering a device that uses radio waves to detect enemy ships?
Not just that, Chester said.
He popped up out of his seat and began to pace the office.
If I'm right, that book contains the calculations and specifications needed to construct a very advanced rangekeeper, one that incorporates the radio wave detector I just told you about.
A rangekeeper?
They're the calculating machines that the Navy uses to direct the firing of long-range guns on board a ship. If the machine described in that notebook gets built, and if it works as it's designed to work, it will give the Navy a very big advantage in the next war.
If there is another war.
Chester stopped pacing. He heaved a sigh, took out a handkerchief, and began polishing his glasses.
As long as human nature is what it is, I'm afraid there will always be another war, he said quietly.
And people tell me that I'm cynical.
Oliver tapped the notebook. What about the laboratory where Atherton worked? Chester put on his glasses.
It will probably come as no surprise to you that the Saltwood Laboratory is rumored to be working on a secret military project. They've got a contract with the Navy, very hush-hush.
And Atherton? Chester grunted.
No one seems to know anything about him, aside from the fact that he's dead. Car accident.
I suppose it will be too easy to just telephone the Saltwood Lab and ask them to send someone out to Burning Cove to pick up this damn notebook.
Chester gave him a grim look. You do that, and the next thing you know, this hotel will be crawling with government agents. You're in the middle of a major espionage case, Oliver. Anyone who knows anything about the notebook, including Miss Glasson and you, will become suspects. You might be able to talk yourselves out of trouble eventually, but once you get on a government list, you're on it for life.
You know, my job was a lot simpler when all I had to worry about was catching a couple of killers.
Chapter 47. Irene was in the tea room, positioned behind a massive potted palm, when Claudia arrived at precisely 3:15, just as the concierge, Mr. Fontaine, had predicted. The waiter seated Claudia in a corner behind another potted palm. As soon as the first cup of tea had been poured, she took her notebook and a pencil out of her handbag. She opened the notebook and bent over it industriously. Irene rose and moved as unobtrusively as possible around the room until she could approach Claudia from behind.
Hello,
she said, trying for a warm, cheery tone. She glanced at a page of Claudia's notes.
I see you know shorthand. I hadn't realized that you trained as a secretary.
Claudia jerked violently and looked up with an expression of near panic.
Oh, it's you, she said.
Her fear metamorphosed into irritation. She closed the notebook with a sharp snap.
What do you want?
Just a short chat. May I sit down? She seated herself quickly before Claudia could decide how to handle the situation. Claudia picked up her teacup.
Mr. Ogden said you got fired from your job at Whispers.
Good news travels fast.
If you're no longer a reporter, why should I talk to you?
Because I plan to get my job back. To do that, I need a scoop.
If you think I'm going to help you pin Gloria Maitland's death on Nick Tremaine, you're crazy. If anything happens to Tremaine, I'm the one who will be unemployed.
Look, you told me from the start that Tremaine's alibi for the Maitland death was solid. I didn't believe you at first, but I do now. Claudia looked wary.
Is that so?
I'm no longer trying to prove that Tremaine killed anyone, but I would like to know more about Daisy Jennings.
I can't help you. I never met the woman. According to the local paper, you found the body.
I was not alone that time. Mr. Ward was with me.
Regardless, it strikes me as something of a coincidence that you were on the scene when another woman was found dead,
Claudia said. Believe me, that thought did occur to me. Shortly before she died, Daisy Jennings contacted me. She claimed she had something important to tell me. Do you have any idea what it was?
Not unless she was trying to get revenge on Mr. Tremaine.
Why would she do that?
Women are always throwing themselves at Mr. Tremaine, but the only thing he's serious about is his career.
Where is Nick Tremaine right now?
At this very minute? Playing golf. Not that it's any of your business.
Alone?
Of course not. Men don't play golf alone. He's with a friend.
Someone from L.A.? Another star?
What?
Claudia frowned.
No. Someone he met here at the hotel. Another guest. Mr. Enright. Stop asking me questions. I would have thought you'd have learned your lesson by now.
What lesson is that?
According to Mr. Ogden at the studio, you lost your job and your landlady tossed you out of your apartment, Claudia said. Isn't that bad enough? The men who run Mr. Tremaine's studio are very powerful people. If you keep asking questions about Nick Tremaine, your life will get even more unpleasant. Believe me. Are you threatening me, Claudia? Me? No. I'm just a lowly assistant. But I've worked at the studio long enough to know that men like Ogden can do a great deal of damage to people who get in their way. If I were you, Miss Glasson, I'd find another story. Leave Nick Tremaine alone.
Sounds like you're afraid of this, Mr. Ogden.
No, Miss Glasson, I'm not afraid of Ernest Ogden. I'm absolutely terrified of him.
Because he could get you fired?
In a heartbeat. Look, I'll tell you the truth. Hollywood was the biggest mistake of my life. I'm not cut out for that world, or this one here in Burning Cove either. I'm just trying to keep my job long enough to get some money together so that I can go home.
What will you do when you go home?
What everyone told me I should do the day I graduated from high school.
Claudia got to her feet and collected her book and her handbag.
Get a job in a department store. Meet a nice guy who can support me. Get married.
Where is home? Irene asked.
A place where you don't need to wear sunglasses every day of the year.
Claudia walked swiftly toward the door of the glass-walled tea room and disappeared out into the gardens. Chapter 48. Irene sat quietly, thinking about what Claudia had said. After a while, she got to her feet and went along the arched walkway to Oliver's office. Elena smiled when she opened the door.
Hello, Irene. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, Elena. And you?
Excellent, thanks. And you here to see Mr. Ward?
Yes. Is he in his office?
He is. I'll let him know you're here.
Elena pressed the intercom button.
Miss Glasson is here, sir.
Send her in. I was about to go looking for her.
Elena started to get to her feet to open the door.
Don't bother, please. I'll get it.
Irene crossed the room. She paused, her hand on the knob, and looked back at Elena.
Do you ever get tired of all the sunshine here in California?
Elena laughed.
Are you kidding? I was born and raised here. I love the light.
Irene smiled. I'm not from around here, but I agree with you. I love the light, too. Oddly enough, not everyone does. She walked into Oliver's office and closed the door behind her. He got to his feet.
There you are, he said. I was about to go looking for you. Chester just briefed me on what he discovered about Atherton's notebook. Those calculations are for a highly advanced version of a military device called a rangekeeper. Saltwood evidently has a secret contract with the Navy.
We're talking about espionage.
That's what it looks like. Chester agrees with the advice that Helen Spencer gave you in her letter, by the way. He says we'll be asking for a lot of trouble if we contact the FBI.
Irene shuddered. We'll become suspects in an espionage case.
Yes.
Good heavens. This thing just gets deeper and deeper, doesn't it?
I think we're finally able to put a few pieces of the puzzle together. Did Teddy help you locate Claudia Picton?
Teddy?
Sorry, Oliver said. He prefers his stage name. Mr. Fontaine. Occasionally I forget. To me, he'll always be Teddy. The guy who somehow got the whole show, crew, props, and equipment packed up and on the right train heading for the next town. The man's brilliant when it comes to logistics.
Claudia was right where Mr. Fontaine said she would be at 3:15, the tea room. I was hoping to rattle her a bit, but she didn't tell me much. She did mention that Nick Tremaine was playing golf with a new acquaintance, someone he met at the hotel.
Who?
A Mr. Enright. Oliver sat down looking thoughtful.
That is very interesting.
Why? She asked, taking a seat.
There is a Julian Enright of New York on my list.
A single man traveling alone?
Yes. A gentleman with expensive tastes and a sense of style. The sort of style that, I'm told, can only be acquired by someone who descends from several generations of moldy money. Mr. Fontaine was very impressed.
You didn't point out this Julian Enright in the hotel restaurant last night.
He wasn't there.
Oliver held up a list with four names on it.
Enright was one of the few who chose to dine in town.
A gentleman with expensive tastes and a sense of style, Irene repeated softly. Doesn't sound like a killer, does he?
Not the Hollywood movie version, perhaps, but do you think it's possible that such a man might have succeeded in deceiving Helen Spencer?
Maybe. Why would a killer on a mission to recover the notebook take up with a hot Hollywood talent?
It's quite possible that Enright is aware of your recent reporting.
So,
since you have helpfully laid the groundwork for pointing the finger of blame at Nick Tremaine in one recent death, why not use Tremaine as cover?
I don't understand.
If something were to happen to you, Irene, who do you think would come under immediate suspicion?
She caught her breath at the sheer audacity of the idea.
Nick Tremaine, she said. Everyone knows he's furious with me because of that piece I wrote for Whispers.
He might have a rock-solid alibi, enough to keep him from going to jail, but that wouldn't matter in the court of public opinion. I wouldn't be surprised if the murder of a certain reporter here in Burning Cove, where Tremaine just happens to be vacationing, might be too much for even a powerful studio to handle. Especially if the murder was staged so that it was clear it was no accident.
A vision of Helen Spencer's bloody corpse flashed into Irene's mind. Her fingers trembled. Perception is everything, she said. There would be a huge scandal, lots of speculation and gossip, and while all that was going on, the real killer would quietly vanish from the scene. It's a stunning idea.
Damned brilliant piece of misdirection when you think about it.
It certainly worked in Helen's murder. The police assumed from the outset that they were looking for an insane killer.
A criminally insane private secretary, to be specific, Oliver said.
No need to remind me. Such a scheme also fits with your sense of the killer's arrogance.
Yes, but if we're right, that arrogance is the plan's fatal flaw.
At least we know the identity of Helen's killer.
We may know it, Oliver said. We need to be certain. Did you get Claudia Picton to say anything else?
Well, she raised the specter of the mysterious Mr. Ogden again.
Men like Ernie Ogden usually resort to cash payments when they want to make problems disappear. But if money doesn't do the job, he wouldn't hesitate to apply brute force to clean up a mess.
I've been focused on Nick Tremaine from the start because of Peggy's notes. But what if she was wrong? Do you think that Ogden might go so far as to have someone murder a woman if he thought she was a threat to his star?
If he couldn't bribe her or frighten her, it's conceivable, Oliver said. But I knew Daisy Jennings. Pell knew her, too. Both of us are convinced that money would have worked. There was no reason to murder her to keep her quiet.
Unless she knew something about Nick Tremaine that was so damaging that Ogden didn't want to take any chances. What if she could implicate Tremaine in Gloria Maitland's murder?
Yeah, that might be enough for Ogden to send in the heavy muscle, but if that's true, it means the studio considers Tremaine absolutely crucial to the bottom line.
I can tell you one thing. Bribery wouldn't have worked with Peggy Hackett.
You're sure?
Peggy was trying to get her career back on track, Irene said. She wasn't after money. She wanted a headline.
Get anything else from Picton?
She warned me that Ogden can be ruthless. It's obvious she's scared of him. She also said she's decided she's not cut out for Hollywood or Burning Cove.
She just wants to get enough money together to go home, get a job, and get married.
Married?
Married. Ever tried it?
No, Oliver said. Came close once upon a time, got engaged, but it didn't work out. You?
Same story. I thought I was going to marry someone once, but it didn't work out.
The lying, cheating bastard you mentioned in the prop locker?
He neglected to mention that he was engaged to someone. When his fiancée informed me of the facts, the lying, cheating bastard thought it was odd that I didn't want to play the part of his mistress.
Oliver nodded with a sage air. Yeah, that lying and cheating stuff will ruin a perfectly good relationship every time.
Irene propped her elbows on the arms of her chair and put her fingertips together. You speak from personal experience, I assume, she said.
I do. She was one of my assistants. Ran off with a man I considered a trusted employee. He handled the bookings, ticket sales, and advance publicity for the act.
I see.
They eloped to Hawaii.
Very romantic. Irene tapped her fingertips together once. Costs money to travel all the way to Hawaii by steamship or airplane, and then there's the price of a hotel room. You must have paid your staff well.
I like to think so, but evidently Dora and Hubert didn't agree. On their way out the door, they helped themselves to the cash receipts from nearly 2 months of performances.
Given that the amazing Oliver Ward usually played to packed houses, that would have been a tidy sum.
It was, Oliver said. They sent me a postcard from Hawaii apologizing and explaining that they could not deny their hearts. Said they hoped I would understand.
Well, look on the bright side, Irene said. At least the card didn't say, wish you were here.
Oliver surprised her with a grin. Thanks for putting things into perspective. Did you get any revenge?
Of the petty sort. The company was in a fierce bidding war with a competitor. The deal involved obtaining the license on a patented device used in the oil business. The lying, cheating bastard was in charge of negotiating the licensing agreement. But I was the one who had done all of the background research. I assembled all the necessary facts and figures. I was about to put everything together in a neat, tidy report for the lying, cheating bastard when the fiancé stopped by the office to inform me of the reality of my situation.
Can I assume that something dire happened to the neat, tidy report?
Nothing at all happened to it, because it never came into existence. That was the beauty of my revenge, you see. On my way out the door, I dropped the file with all the raw data on the lying, cheating bastard's desk. I knew he wouldn't be able to make heads or tails out of my notes. They were all in shorthand, my own private version.
Oliver smiled. They might as well have been written in a secret code.
As for the figures, well, he was the first to admit that he never did have a head for numbers.
I'm guessing the deal fell through.
The rival company obtained the license to the device.
Was the lying, cheating bastard fired? Oliver asked.
Of course not. His fiancée was the daughter of the owner of the company, and she was determined to marry the lying, cheating bastard. The fiancée was Daddy's little girl, so the lying, cheating bastard got promoted to vice president.
Naturally.
I've heard that revenge rarely works out well. Last I heard, the bastard and his wife were living happily ever after somewhere in Connecticut. A real Hollywood ending.
I doubt it.
So do I, Irene said. Truth be told, I even feel sorry for her. After all, she married a lying, cheating bastard.
People don't change. They are what they are.
That's my theory, too. Irene said.
Chapter 49. The dance floor of the Paradise Club was crowded with men in expensively cut dinner jackets and women in delicate gowns. The members of the orchestra, sharply dressed in white coats and black bow ties, were playing a popular number. The booth where Irene sat with Oliver was one of many similarly intimate seating arrangements scattered around the room. There was a martini in front of Oliver and a pink lady in front of Irene, but the glasses were still full. They had not come here to enjoy themselves, Irene thought. They were here so that Oliver could get a closer look at Julian Enright. She was very conscious of the shadows that cloaked the club. The low, floor-level lighting and the candles on the tables were designed to enhance the intimate atmosphere. The high backs and the semicircular design of the upholstered booths ensured privacy for the couples that occupied them, but they also made it impossible to see most of the other club patrons once they were seated. Irene leaned forward and lowered her voice.
How will we know if Enright and Tremaine show up?
Don't worry. Nick Tremaine is a rising movie star, Oliver said. Stars don't walk into a nightclub. They make entrances.
While trying to give the impression that they don't want to be noticed, Irene concluded. But maybe he'll decide to come alone.
Stars don't go out to fashionable nightclubs alone, either.
I agree that's generally how it works in Hollywood, but Enright might not want the attention.
If he was concerned about being noticed, he wouldn't have become Tremaine's pal.
Irene considered that briefly. I can't argue with that logic, but it sure seems strange that a killer would want so much attention.
Who says professional killers can't be just as vain as movie stars? Besides, if Enright is planning to use Tremaine as cover, he has no choice but to get close to him.
Luther Pell materialized out of the shadows. He smiled at Irene, a gleam of masculine appreciation in his eyes.
You look lovely tonight, he said.
She smiled. Thank you.
Oliver frowned. Any sign of Tremaine and Enright?
That's what I came to tell you, Luther said. They just arrived. I've arranged for them to be seated at one of the star booths that borders the dance floor.
Star booth? Irene said.
We reserve the tables around the dance floor for patrons we know want to be seen, Luther explained. You'll have a good view of Tremaine and Enright. If either of them leaves the club for any reason, one of my security people will keep an eye on him. Let me know if you need anything else.
Thanks, Oliver said, his tone a little gruff. We'll do that.
Luther's mouth kicked up in an amused smile. He moved on to greet another couple in a nearby booth, playing the gracious nightclub host to the hilt. Irene glared at Oliver.
He's not flirting with me, you know. He's just being polite. I'm sure he tells all of the women who come to his club that they look nice.
Probably.
Oliver did not sound convinced.
Here comes Tremaine and Enright.
Fine. Change the subject. See if I care.
His jaw tensed.
I was just teasing you, she said.
I know, he muttered.
He wasn't really jealous, she thought. He was just feeling a little possessive. Men got that way when they were sleeping with a woman. It was a perfectly natural, perfectly temporary, perfectly superficial masculine response. It didn't imply a deeper, more abiding emotion. It occurred to her that she would be irritated if one of the glamorous women in the room happened to stop by to tell Oliver that he looked very attractive tonight. A perfectly natural, temporary, superficial female response. It didn't imply a deeper, more abiding emotion.
Heaven help her if it did.
Before she could reflect on that realization, she saw Nick Tremaine and Julian Enright.
You are right, she said. Here they come, and it would be hard to miss them.
The two men were escorted down an aisle by the maitre d'. A subtle beam of light appeared as if by magic. It lingered lovingly on Nick Tremaine. Enright was careful to remain a few steps behind the star, as if he didn't want to steal the scene. But he managed to catch the spotlight for a brief moment. In those few seconds, his hair glowed gold, and his square-jawed profile drew the eye. Irene heard a low buzz of excitement rise and fall in the shadows as the crowd became aware of the new arrivals.
So that's him, Irene whispered.
Yes, Oliver said.
He looks
handsome, polished, sophisticated.
Actually, I was thinking that he looks like a movie star. The pair were seated in one of the booths that ringed the dance floor. The maitre d' raised his hand in a signal. A cocktail waitress arrived.